bulletin board. Our main speaker tonight is Lorna.
I wonder what Wilbur did. Good evening, everybody. My name is Lorna, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm very delighted to be here. And, you know, I walked up Park Avenue, or down Park Avenue, and past 62nd Street, where all that houses exploded yesterday. And I thought to myself, my God, you know, that's the end result of a resentment. I mean, that's what it can look like. And not only that, not only does one bring the house down, but one brings the house down on top of oneself. And he didn't get to die, you know. He got, what a mess. I mean, what a lesson it was. It was incredible. Anyway, you know, I've been sitting here for the last half hour, and I want to thank Maureen and David for their share. And I've been thinking and praying, please help me, you know, to say something and something to come through. And I never really know what I'm going to say, but I do want to say that this is a very poignant time of year for me, because this is the time of year I came in. And I came in the year of 1976, and it was just like this. It was hot and humid. And I often describe my coming into the program as sort of like I was a plane that belly flopped along the runway for a long time. You know, and my undercarriage got all scraped and the wings were torn off and there were passengers strewn across the runway and, you know, underwear hanging from trees and bushes and things. But it was just mucky. It wasn't some glorious bottom. It was just mucky. And this time of year, my anniversary is August 11th, and this was the time of year where I was scraping along the runway, and just it was getting muckier and muckier and muckier. But I was coming into AA. But I want to actually start my talk tonight with how I very often end it, because something very major, in a very small thing happened, but it has major significance. And, you know, I think very often newcomers, I was amazed at the amount of people that are going to celebrate a year, and this group certainly supports newcomers a lot, that get this idea, especially in a group like this, that sobriety is very rah, 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 and that if one doesn't feel rah, 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 all one's sobriety, one automatically thinks one isn't doing it right. I've done it wrong. There's something wrong with me. You know, I've got 8 years of sobriety, and I'm feeling terrible, and I don't really like meetings, and I can't stand my sponsor. And, you know, they always say if you love your sponsor, you've got the wrong sponsor. And this feeling of, it's not all like this, and Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety calls to us to tread the high road. It calls to us to go higher. Sobriety is one thing. Yeah, there's go. But it calls to us to take it into a bigger, wider, finer, more sparkly kind of dimension. And the price for that is very often very painful. And you know, Susan's here, and she's often been to meditation retreats I've given, so she's heard me say this before, that, you know, every one of us at some time in our lives, and especially in our lives as members of Alcoholics Anonymous, we're called to be the sensing rod of AA. We're called to be the sensing rod of how will it go. Each one of us is the program. Each one of us is Alcoholics Anonymous. And every so often, every one of us gets that opportunity. And we have it so incredibly demonstrated with Bill Wilson when he was standing in that lobby in Akron, Ohio. And, you know, he was hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. And he heard the bar down the other end of the lobby. And it was like, you know, Lois isn't around, no one's here to see me. The business had gone south. He was all alone. And I'm sure heaven watched him and heaven held its breath. Which way will he go? You know, I'm come from a Christian tradition, and I love the idea of the Annunciation when the angel came to Mary, and the angel didn't say, "Hey, listen, sweetheart, you're going to be the mother of, the Son of God," and that's it. Just invited her, and heaven held its breath. Which way was she going to go? Was she going to say, "Look, I'm awfully busy, I really don't want to take this on at the moment"? Or was she going to agree to it? And, you know, and Bill Wilson there. And based on what he did, all of us are sitting here tonight. And I'm sober almost 30 years because that man turned in another direction and went towards the church directory. And every so often, each one of us is called, am I going to cheat on my expense account? Everyone else does it. And I need a little extra cash, you know. Am I going to serve alcohol at home? I mean, after all, it's Christmas or my daughter's wedding or something. And, AA is wonderful when I'm at 60th and Park. But this is the real world, you know. This is the real world. How is it going to be? And heaven holds its breath. How are we going to claim? Are we going to live it in the real world? So many years ago, some of you know I was very friendly with Mother Teresa, and she was dreadfully ill, and I dashed off to Calcutta. We thought she was going to die at that time. And I was taken from the airport to her hospital room. Now, here's Mother Teresa in bed, and at that time we thought dying. And she was in a very, very narrow room. It wasn't much wider, actually, than this aisle here. And a tiny bed, and very shortly after I got there, a young Indian priest came in to say Mass. And they set up the table at the bottom of the bed as the altar, and he started saying Mass, facing Mother, who's in bed, propped up on her pillows. Now, it's not lost on me at all that I'm, in the hospital room with Mother Teresa dying, and there's the priest saying Mass. So anyway, it comes time for communion, and he comes around the side of the bed, and he's holding the chalice, and he dips the host in the wine. And Mother pushes herself up from the pillows and very serenely and with great attention, she takes the wine, the host on her lips, on her tongue. And then he turns to me, and it went like this, but it was, "Oh God, not here. Don't let me have to make a fuss here." I mean, I was about 17, 18 years sober at the time, and I thought, please, this saint is dying in bed next to me. Let me just move over it this one time. Why do I always have to bring the attention on to myself? Why does it have... Just take it this one time, Lorna. After all, it's the blood of Christ. Don't even think of it as being wine or booze or anything. It's this sacramental liquid. And so I'm standing there, and all of a sudden, all of you went before me. And all of the people that had gone before me, and Bill Wilson standing in that lobby in his shabby old suit, and all the people that have tried and gone out the doors and come back, and what you don't see with me standing here tonight, what you don't see is behind me there's a river of humanity. There's a river of suffering humanity, some not even born, that held their breath. What will she do? Which way will she go? Will Alcoholics Anonymous be a little more, or will it be a little less? And I just said to him, no wine, just give me the host. I mean, I didn't know quite the formal words to say. And he's a young priest, and he was confused and that. And anyway, finally, he gave me the plain host, and he gave this dripping wine-soaked host to the sister standing next to me. And we're all crammed in, you know, like this. And then he moves around the other side of the bed to give communion to the other two sisters who were squashed on the other side of the bed. And while he was around, and I'm standing there, you know, when we do the right thing, we don't necessarily feel, oh, now that feels great, you know. And heaven sure is happy with me, and Alcoholics Anonymous is moving forward because I did the right thing. No, I stood there feeling really awkward, like I've pulled attention onto myself, and just I wasn't feeling holy. I wasn't felt like I took the blood of the body of Christ, or none of that. And Mother's hand came across the covers, and she took my hand, and she leaned into me, and she said, "Well done. You must continue to protect your precious gift." And, you know, I have to... Could you pass me my water, would you mind? Thank you. And I have to constantly remember that I have a precious gift, and sometimes it requires a price. Now, the other evening, I took a friend of mine out for dinner on a Sunday evening, and it was a birthday celebration for him. And I took him to a very nice restaurant, and I've never been to a fancy restaurant with him, never gone. We've always sort of gone to a coffee shop or anything like that. And I have a suspicion about his drinking. But I've never seen him with a drink in his hand, never, because he knows I'm in the program. And we talk about, we're both on very intense spiritual paths, and we talk about our AA and the 12 steps a lot. So anyway, when I sat down, I said, you know, shall we get would you like a large bottle of Pellegrino, and we'll share that? So he said, yes, and he said, and Lorna, I would like just an itsy-bitsy glass of red wine. And you know when people start talking about itsy-bitsy, you know they have problems. So I said to him, and this is where the rubber meets the road, I said to him, yeah, absolutely fine, but Andrew, I never buy alcohol, and neither do I pay for it. And, you know, I thought about it a while before I said it, but that feeling, you know, I made a covenant with God when I came into AA that I would have nothing, I would take the first step extremely deeply and in an extreme way, and that I would sink into the first step, you know, that wine would not, that alcohol in any form would not pass my lips, my threshold, my life, my purse, in any way whatsoever. I would not have truck with it because I'm powerless over it. And any time I make allowances for it, I will eventually make those allowances in myself. So, you know, I said to him, I don't buy it. And here I am buying him his birthday dinner. And then I had to take it a step further. And he said, oh, all right. He said, but I'll buy it. I'll pay for it. And I sat there in this very smart restaurant, and he handed me the $6. Now, what did I need with $6? I didn't need the $6. The meal was very expensive. But it was just that act and that feeling of embarrassment and cringing to stand by my principles. And what was I, I'm almost 30 years, and on the eve of my 30 years, was I going to say, oh, in this case it's different? And believe me, I wanted to. Believe me, I was paying for it with a credit card, and it's like, oh, what difference does it make? I won't notice it. It's not like I have to open the wine or anything. It doesn't matter. But it just felt, it felt tacky. It didn't feel cool. It didn't feel New York. It didn't feel, you know, to have someone that I'm buying their birthday dinner for give me the money for the booze that they're drinking. And, you know, I've managed to do it for 30 years almost, and I feel I didn't sell out. I didn't sell out, but it's not easy. So I just want to say that because, you know, it's not always, it's doing great big things in our lives are often much easier than these tiny little, you know, refinements. You know, what's the difference between an Armani suit and something you get off, you know, somewhere else? I don't know what the other makes are from tea. But It's the cut, it's the refinement, it's the finesse of it. That's why, I haven't seen The Devil Wears Prada yet, but I'm sure it talks about that. Anyway, you know, thank you. At this, I have 15 minutes left, but I've said exactly what I wanted to say. So the rest is just fill in. And at this... At this time of the year, you know, as I said, it's a very poignant time, and my bottom was actually, I'll talk about it like this. I had this very highfalutin job. I was the first woman art auctioneer in America at Sotheby's, and I loved to drink on an empty stomach. And I liked to fast all day, and I would, in those days, Sotheby's was on Madison Avenue and 76th Street, and Bemelman's Bar was right across the street in the Carlisle Hotel. And I'd love to go across the street with my associates and have a drink on an empty stomach. You know, that first vodka and orange juice, woof! And I was there one evening. My marriage had broken up. My husband had finally walked out the door. I thought it was the most fascinating thing he'd ever done, and it really caught my attention. And I wanted him back desperately. And some friend of mine just said to me that she'd gone to a meeting of Al-Anon, and all the women sounded just like me. So anyway, I went to this meeting of Al-Anon, and it was suggested that one go to open AA meetings. So I researched, and the very next night, and I knew that there was a meeting at Lenox Hill at 7:30, I think it was, on Thursday, and it was an open meeting. So that evening, I'm in Bemelman's Bar, and it's almost 7:30. And I said to my friends, ooh, it's almost 7:30. I'm going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll be back. And I toddled up the road to Lenox Hill, and I went in and I sat down, and, you know, it was a meeting where people like me who were not alcoholics could attend. So I listened. This chap got up on the stage, and he said, hello, my name's Don, and I'm an alcoholic. And I remember thinking to myself, well, good God, we don't all want to know. I mean, you know, surely there's some things you keep to yourself. So don't you have any shame? But the thing was that I was riveted to this guy's story, fascinated with it. And I think that that is what qualifies me as an alcoholic. I think if one comes to these meetings and one finds it interesting to hear stories about how people, you know, threw up on their clients and ended up in jail or contemplated suicide or murder or decided to blow up the house so the wife couldn't get it or, you know. And we find that sort of thing fascinating. You know, there's something not quite right with us. And not only did I find it fascinating, do I find it fascinating after all this time? I like to go to coffee shops afterwards and talk about it and get on the phone and talk about it. I find it endlessly interesting. Anyway, after Don, two other fellows got up and told equally as interesting stories. And after this, I went back to Bemelman's Bar. And what did I know about anonymity? I knew nothing. I thought it was a jolly good job you were anonymous. You should be after all the things you got up to. But I said to my friends, oh my God, you'd never guess who is an alcoholic. And I told them all details about their story and all sorts of things. Anyway, that was my introduction to AA, and that was sort of in June of 76. And by August, I'd gone to London on a business trip, and I was at a very, very smart dinner dance with all Sotheby's clients and heads of museums and Lord and Lady Duwa Diddy and God knows who and that. And I'm in a gown and all dressed up. And while they're dancing, I'm going from table to table, emptying their glass into mine. And I knew there was something, my behavior didn't quite go with my outfit. But I couldn't, I didn't know what it was that was, you know, couldn't quite put it together. Anyway, I think heaven was looking out and going, oy vey, you know, when's this one going to? But in August 1st of 1976, I ended up, I was sitting on the steps of the Metropolitan Museum of Art on a summer Sunday afternoon. And you've all seen that scene. You know, life was going on all around me. There were people with people, friends, and people going in the museum. What time is it now? Good. People going in and out of the museum, and I knew that it was life. I knew that it was something that echoed something I remembered, but I couldn't get to it. It was like I was looking at life through a thick plastic window. And, you know, up until that moment, I'd never felt so lonely in all my life. And that was a morning I'd gotten up and I'd fixed myself a carafe of vodka and orange juice. And I'd been drinking all day. And I'd had lunch with a man I was going out with. I was devastated about the husband, but I was going out with this other chap I wanted to marry. You know how mucky it all gets in the end. And he was a bit of a cad. I mean, we're never going out with the cream of the crop when we're coming into the program. So, and usually not for the first couple of years either. So, in my case, it was, okay, I don't write anywhere else. But anyway, I stood up and I didn't know what to do with myself. And this thought came to me, go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to a meeting. I went to the Moravian Church at Lexington Avenue and 30th Street. And a woman spoke, and she was sort of my build, actually. And she looked ancient. She was probably as old as I am now. But she had broken capillaries. I remember this on her face. And she looked like, you know, rough. Used, rough. And she told my story up to where I was at that very moment. And then she went on for another 15 years. And I got to see coming attractions. I got to see, that's me. I mean, it hit me. There was no difference between her and myself. There was just a matter of moments, 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 which add up to years and years. And you know, boom, you're 20, boom, you're 30, boom, you're 40, boom. And now I'm sober. And now I'm sober half my life. I'm 60 years old. And, you know, it's gone. And so I got in that, I had a grace in that moment to see myself down the path and how fast it was coming at me. And the thing was, so, and I said to myself over and over again, my God, I drink. It's drinking. I drink. And the thought was so terrible, I ran out onto Lexington Avenue into the nearest bar and knocked back another one. And but I was across the threshold. I was in AA. I didn't understand it. I didn't know what to do. I thought for the longest time I'd nipped it in the bud. I thought I didn't need this program quite like the rest of you because I was young. In those days, 30 was young to be coming in. And Maureen said, you know, I didn't know I was an alcoholic. Of course we don't know we're alcoholic. I mean, that's part of the disease. It's not a fault that we don't know. That knowing that we're alcoholics is something that comes with sobriety. It's not something we know instantly. And anyway, 10 days after that, I was in Washington on business. And I was at a business dinner. And wine was poured. And I didn't know enough to say no thank you. I didn't know. I thought Alcoholics Anonymous, and listen up to this, because it's summertime, and there's a lot of seductive-looking, refreshing drinks out there. I thought Alcoholics Anonymous was learning to resist alcohol. I thought it was learning to be around alcohol and be cool. Like, no, 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 it doesn't bother me if you drink. No, 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 you go ahead. It's fine. Ladies and gentlemen, I am not in here to learn how to be cool, to learn that, to say, no, it doesn't bother me. I did not have a platonic relationship with alcohol. We had an incestuous, involved dance. We tangoed together. And I don't, you know, but I thought it was about resisting. And I resisted it through the main course and the salad and the dessert. And then they started serving cheese and whatever, and this goblet of wine started to talk to me. And it said to me, look, Lorna, these other people at the table aren't weeping and telling each other, you know, inappropriate details of their personal lives. And they're not laughing too loudly. They're dressed appropriately. Why can't you be like them? I'm not against you. I'm on your side. Don't you always feel better when we're together? Why do you always have to guzzle? Why can't you be like them? And I took the goblet and I took a sip of wine, and my last drink was that sip of wine, because that sip sent my soul into total terror, and the terror was being separated from you. I'm not always in love with my sobriety. I'm deeply shallow, and I don't wake up every morning with this glorious feeling of, oh, I'm sober, how wonderful. But I want to tell you that the thing that was drilled into me, was develop a love affair with Alcoholics Anonymous. If you fall in love with AA, it will help you through the dry periods. It'll help you through the 8 years, the 12 years, the 20 years. It'll help you through so that you can have a long-term, glorious relationship. And, you know, I have a lot to share. I have a lot to say. But I... it's my time, and, you know, my life is extraordinary. I've been on a diet of a meeting a day my entire sobriety, except if I've been traveling, and I travel. I spend 2 months a year of my life in silence, and, you know, I just have a very abundant, incredible life. But it's not pain-free, and it's not angst-free, and I'm still cantankerous and fiery and irritated, and was demonstrated when I walked in here this evening with one of the members, and I apologize. What has happened is that my life has become bigger so that I can hold all that I am. I'm not going to stop being impatient or irritable. Those things won't go away, but they don't last as long. They don't wreck my life like they did. And, you know, I'm one of many in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'm very important. And each one of us must feel that way, because we hold within us the chalice and the crucible of an incredible message. And Mother Teresa loved AA, and she, Mother could help every form of suffering human, but she couldn't help the alcoholic, because she didn't have the words of everlasting life that you and I have. And those words are, I know how you feel, let me tell you what happened to me. So you and I are the owners and the stewards for our lifetimes. And it's not, we do not do this for ourselves alone. It's not so that our lives will be glorious. It's so that we'll take this message and send it out into the world. We don't want the sobriety of Bill Wilson. We want, more. So thank you so much for coming to meetings. Thank you, Vince, for asking me to speak. Thank you for all the service you do. Thank you for putting money in the basket, and for keeping the alcohol out of your houses, and for keeping a scrupulous life. Because if you weren't here, I'd have absolutely nowhere to go. So thank you for your sobriety.